Today's the 21st, isn't it?
That's correct.
Yeah. This is Mae Warren. Today is the 21st of September, 1996. I'm with Sean Copeland in Lexington, Virginia. And it hadn't been all that long ago that you left Lexington, Virginia.
That's correct.
But what made you come here in the first place?
Well, I'm originally from Charleston, West Virginia. My family still lives there. And for whatever reason, when I was going through junior high school and high school, my attention up until about my junior year in high school was focused primarily west of Charleston to Ohio and Indiana. My dad had gone to the University of Michigan in Indiana. And my mother is a hairdresser and has been, and still is, cutting the hair of a woman named Stuart Smith, who is the wife of a former trustee of Washington and Lee, Ike Smith. And she heard that I was looking around at certain schools and thought it'd be a good idea if my parents introduced me to Lexington and to Washington and Lee. And the spring of my junior year, my father took a week off from work during my spring break, and we were going to do an abbreviated college visit, and since we couldn't visit all the schools I was interested in, he thought it'd be best if we looked at some mix of big schools and small schools and private schools and public schools. And we started in Lexington with little old Washington and Lee, and I remember pulling into the parking lot at the foot of the campus next to Lee Chapel and walking up through the trees and seeing the colonnade, and almost immediately I felt like this was the place. It was just beautiful. It was collegiate looking, and I had a wonderful visit here. My dad, while I was being interviewed, I think in the admissions office, joked about walking from one end of town to the next. He thought that the University of Michigan was the place to be because it was huge, it was cosmopolitan, its campus offered everything you could ever want. It was like a smorgasbord, he used to boast. And so for all purposes, for all intents and purposes, the trip for me ended here with our first stop. After that, we went out west and looked at some schools, University of Michigan being one of them. I didn't even apply to the University of Michigan. But I applied to Washington and Lee, and was fortunate enough to be accepted, and really wasn't much of an issue for me. There were some other schools that some might think were more prestigious that I either had been admitted to or was on the waiting list, and I gave it some pause thinking, well, maybe other people are right, but in my gut I felt like this was the right place.
What other schools?
Harvard and Georgetown, the main ones. Then there's the state school down the road, UVA. And I also, I should also say that another factor that influenced my decision to come to Washington and Lee was I was a swimmer in high school, and I wanted to continue to swim and, if possible, play water polo in college. I'd never played water polo before, but I was kind of on the borderline where I could have competed at a Division II or maybe even Division I school, but it would have been a big commitment, and I would not have been a big fish, so to speak. You know, I would have been a small fish in a big pond. And I also didn't want to shortchange the kind of education I was getting. I was afraid that would happen at a place that even offered the possibility of an athletic scholarship. And at that time, Paige Remillard, who's still the swim coach here, was in touch with me when he learned of my interest, and I sent him all my times, and was very, I think, instrumental also in reassuring me that this was the right place to come to. It was a done deal from very early on. And I'm, you know, I'd never look back, I think, after I made that decision. And my father, who, for all his boasting about how small and rinky-dink and elitist Washington and Lee was at the time that I was in high school, now, 10 years later, I think would be quick to admit that this place was the right place for me, that I made the right decision. And he can see that my relationship with Washington and Lee is continuing even after I'm gone as a student, and he has very little contact with his schools that he went to, other than watching them play football on TV, which I can't do exactly with WNL.
Now, you arrived in 1986.
I did. You know, last night as I was driving over here from Richmond, I was reflecting on my time here, and it struck me, the date struck me, that it was 10 years ago this fall that I first set foot on campus as a student. And actually, water polo is a fall sport, and like football, we have a preseason, which means that the athletes are required to come back before the beginning of classes. Significantly, in the case of water polo, we're usually back, I think at that time it was the beginning of the second week of August, or maybe the, I don't want to embellish too much, maybe it was the middle of August, but it was a good 3 weeks before classes started. And we'd have three practices a day, at least. We always used to joke about the football team complaining about their two-a-days and about how rough it was. And I think we viewed ourselves as the true elite, the Green Berets, or the SEALs, maybe is a more appropriate analogy, of the athletes at WNL, just because we did spend a lot of time at it. We were up early and either training on land or in the water until late at night on occasions.
And you all did pretty well.
We did for a small school. Right, you know, off the top of my head, I don't know what our win-loss record was in all of the seasons that I played, but we competed against larger schools on the East Coast, that some of which were scholarship schools, Division I schools, or schools that were perennially powerhouses because they drew from a bigger pool of athletes mm-hmm. and applicants than we did, like the Naval Academy and Brown. We competed very favorably against them. We had a lot of success against comparably sized Division III schools. Mm-hmm. But when I first showed up on campus, I had picked up a water polo ball maybe twice in my life, and here I was, kind of a scrawny. I was a little underweight for my size when I showed up. Some very good condition because I had a high school swim coach who was of a school of thought that the more the better, so we could swim from dawn till dusk. But you know, the first year or two was just a time really for me learning and watching the more experienced players and the upperclassmen and learning from them. Sometimes through painful mistakes. But
tell me about water polo.
About water polo in general, or water polo at Washington and Lee, or
yes, both.
Both. Water polo in general. Have you ever seen a game?
Mm-mm. But you've raised my interest.
Well, if you have a chance, you should walk over to the pool one weekend when the team's playing and see it. It's I like to describe it as hockey, basketball, lacrosse, soccer, and wrestling in a pool. No pads other than a slight headgear, and it's a goal. You know, it's the lay of the field is much like in soccer or hockey, with two goals and a goalie. And a very demanding sport. It's not much fun to play if you're not conditioned to play it. And so that's, you know, why we spent so much time conditioning in August of every year. I think Washington and Lee was fortunate to have, and is still fortunate to have, Pedro Millard here. He really brought water polo to Washington and Lee. I think it had been played at some level before he came here, but he came from Southern California, the mecca of water polo in the United States, where, you know, people play water polo like a pickup game, like people play pickup basketball or football here in the East Coast, or on any playground on the East Coast. And so he was a great teacher, and he had a knack for attracting talented athletes who were also interested in the Washington Lee experience. And my generation, I think, I'm sure all athletes kind of go back as they think back upon their time and romanticize and glorify the time that they spent there. But we had a cluster of, I'd say, 10 or 15, well, probably about 10 swimmers and water polo players, men, who were really pretty tight together. We, over time, well, even before I got here, came to be known as Sigma Aqua, kind of a mock fraternity. Most of us were independents. We were not members of fraternities, although not some of us were fraternity members. But generally, we were spending so much time either at practice or away on weekends at games or during the swim season at swim meets that we, you know, really didn't make much sense to us to be paying dues to fraternities for other people to buy beer for other people. So we naturally we spent so much time together that we grew very close, and we even had a house on Henry Street, 108 Henry Street, across from a little Pentecostal church, a black with a black congregation, which we kind of made strange neighbors, I think. But there were, I think, five or six of us that would live there every year, and it was called Sigma Aqua, and everyone around campus knew it as Sigma Aqua. And I think we competed pretty favorably, not only in the water, but also on the weekends when we were around and we saw fit to throw a party. We had a pretty good crowd that we attracted, and we had fun with Christmas parties and homecoming and other times like that. We would have cocktail parties and sometimes invite professors over, and it was a really neat experience. People often ask me what life was like as an independent at Washington and Lee, given the strength of the fraternity system here. And I really think that had it not been for that group of friends and that association, that loose association of athletes that we had, it would have been a much different experience. Because we, in a sense, were more of a fraternity than a lot of so-called fraternities or Greek organizations were. I mean, we really had something deep that we shared, and that we shared in each other's lives pretty closely just because of the amount of time that we spent with one another. I mean, we're here in the library now, and my memory races back to what a typical day would be like, and we would, you know, wake up in the morning, and although during the academic year two practices a day were not sanctioned by the school, I mean, you could not mandate that athletes do that for academic reasons, but nevertheless, an optional practice, truly optional in a sense, in the morning could take place, and if it was unsupervised, if there weren't coaches barking and whatnot. And we would, most of us on the water polo team and swim team, would be up in the morning in the weight room before class, we'd get showered and changed and go to breakfast together in the dining hall, and then we would go to class. And then at 3 o'clock, practice would start up, and we'd practice from 3 o'clock to 6 o'clock. And we'd go to dinner together in the dining hall, and then usually around 7, we would wander to the library in a pack and stay here until probably 11 or 12 or so, and then usually walk back to Sigma Aqua together, and or to wherever we were living, if we were living at Sigma Aqua. And it was a neat experience. We were often haggard by the end of the day, and we would take breaks, taking naps underneath the study carrels and waking each other up to study. Probably less studying and more napping than actually got done here, but it was a real neat time in my life, and there's a real camaraderie with those guys that we still share. I mean, I'm going in 2 weeks to the wedding of one of these guys, and was at another's wedding just a month ago, and really still keep in touch and still relive the glory days as much as we can. And you know, we're all now at points in our lives, well, a few of us are, I think I might be the only doctor, or the only attorney. I think there are two or three that are doctors, and one that's a CPA, one that's a broadcaster in Charlotte, television broadcaster, and is trying to break on to the scene. One's a first lieutenant in the Marine Corps. So it was a very neat experience, and I don't know that my life, you know, my experience at Washington and Lee would have been as rosy as it was as an independent on this campus were it not for that. I had.
Do you think you would have been an independent if you weren't on the...
That's a good question. I think probably I would have joined a fraternity. Although we had members of, I guess we were pretty open. We had people on the team, and when I say the team, usually I refer to both the water polo team and the swim team, because most people who did one also did the other. Or I should say most water polo players, almost all of them, also swam, although not all the swimmers played water polo.
Mm-hmm.
But we had some who were dual citizens. They were both a Sigma Chi or a Phi Delt, who were also Sigma Aqua. But I didn't really see the need for, you know, to be a member of a formal fraternity.
Did you tell me, though, when you got into law school, you did join a fraternity?
Yeah, that was an interesting experience and turn of events. I took 2 years in between college and law school. And when I came back to campus, through some contacts that I had from my undergraduate days, there were a few folks at the Sigma Phi Epsilon house, which in my days as an undergraduate was known as the SPE house, and still sometimes is, but I think there's been a campaign to initiated by the house and by the national fraternity to refer to as Sig Ep. Because they thought SPE was somehow derogatory. I don't see. I'm not exactly clear about that, but in any event, when I came back, I was approached by a couple of these guys, and they asked me if I'd be interested in being what was called a resident scholar for the house. And that is a position that is, I'm not sure that's unique to SPE, but it's not an office that all of the houses at Washington and Lee have. Most houses have, you know, the traditional panoply of student officers, the president and treasurer and vice president, social chairman and whatnot. And then they have a house advisor, an academic advisor, a member of the faculty or staff who's their formal liaison to the faculty and to the administration. And I fell someplace in between the two as the resident scholar at Sigma Phi Epsilon. And because of the friendship that I had with some of these folks, I accepted it, and I really didn't fully start in the position until I was a second-year law student. And it was kind of neat. They actually initiated me. I didn't have to go through a pledgeship as if I were a freshman, but when the end of my first-year law school came around, it was time that they were initiating their new undergraduate members. They actually initiated me. And it's been a wonderful thing. It's like I've had the best of both worlds, going through the first time as an undergraduate and not being involved in the Greek system, and then as a law student being involved with it in a very loose sense. I mean, I didn't spend a lot of time at the fraternity through law school, but there are friends that I made through that position that I imagine I'll have for some time. A couple that are in Richmond right now, where I live, that I keep up with and see regularly, and others who have scattered across the country.
Sounds great to be a resident scholar.
It sounds pretty...
Very flattering.
Yeah. I carried a pretty heavy load. Actually, I think that as the job description of the resident scholar was essentially to oversee the academic standing of the brothers, that to help advise them, make sure that they were academically squared away. I didn't have to lift a finger really in that department, because just year in and year out, that fraternity has been either the top or among the top couple of fraternities academically, and really the guys in that house have been self-starters, and so my formal responsibilities there, or the tasks that went along, that were really pretty light, thanks to the guys. And so most of what I did was just hang around every now and again and get to know them. And I did attend house meetings, and at times, I think because of my experience and having gone through 4 years here and spending some time in the working world and coming back, I was able sometimes to temper a response here and there, or to offer a point of view that maybe the house wasn't seeing on a particular issue or something. But by and large, it was I don't feel like I had to do a whole lot. What I did there was essentially what I chose to do, and it was a great opportunity for me to, again, sort of be a part of the fraternity system without having to lug along the baggage that goes along with it. It's
a free ride. You did it real well, Sean.
All right.
Now, another thing that's interesting about the time that you were here is that you arrived with the second year of women?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm sure as you talk to other people from my generation, probably a couple schools of thought on this. But I never was one of the Washington and Lee men whose first choice in terms of dating or social interaction with women was, quote, down the road at one of the girls' schools, or I guess now that I'm 28, I should call them women's colleges. Mm-hmm. But I just from the time that I showed up on campus, Well, let me back up a step. When I showed up as a freshman, the junior and senior classes were still all male, and they were still fighting the co-education battle. I mean, there are all kinds of T-shirts and bumper stickers that were still being printed anew. Some of them were pretty crass, and some of them were pretty humorous. Some of them were good-natured, and some of them were just mean-spirited. I think, again, a lot of the way that I looked at the landscape of Washington Lee was affected by my relationship with the aquatics teams. Again, I mean, in a sense, the folks on those teams and my friends there, they had first crack at me. I showed up as a freshman 3 weeks before any of the other freshmen or any of the other students showed up, and there was no one else around on campus but those folks. And at that time, that was the second year of the women's swim team. And the first year of the women's swim team had 3 women swimmers. I think my year probably added another 4 or 5 to that. And I don't know what it was, but it wasn't as though I looked at students from the women's colleges as somehow contraband or anything or less desirable. It's just that I tended to date and spend time with girls that I had met on campus in class. Or, you know, on the swim team. I did have a few limited experiences going down the road, as they say, and I dated a girl at Sweetbriar, I think, when I was, I think it was the spring term of my sophomore year. And I'm glad that I had that opportunity, because it was, you know, spring term is always a nice time around Washington and Lee, and I got to spend probably as much time at Sweetbriar as I did in Lexington that spring, and it was a neat thing to be able to do. But you know, I just tended to spend time on this campus, and I think the aquatics team was generally that way as well. I mean, those members of the team that were in fraternities, I think particularly when they were freshmen and sophomores, they would spend a fair amount of time at fraternity functions or at some of the women's colleges. But really, they kind of grew out of it too, and it was it just seemed the more natural thing to do, to spend time with the people that you get to know on a daily basis around campus here.
But did you find yourselves in the minority doing that, or do you think that was that your circle of friends, or was that in general you saw that happening?
My freshman year, I'd say probably the minority. And then as the years went by and there were more women on campus here, and the classes that were all male and that had, you know, had, that could drive the road to Sweetbriar or Hollins with their eyes closed, as they graduated and moved on, and the school, you know, as you would expect, became much more accustomed to co-education and became more of a way of life. And gradually over time, it became the norm, as it is, I expect, right now. I think still it's most heavily in the Greek system, is where you'll find people dating outside of the Washington and Lee community. And even within those circles, I would imagine it's probably the freshmen and sophomores, but I'm not I've reached that point now where I'm no longer an expert on
sure.
on that for that this era.
Did you get pressure from the upperclassmen about? Did you see? I shouldn't say you particularly, but did you see pressure? Did you see behavior that was unwelcoming to the women?
Well, yeah, as I mentioned, you know, the T-shirts and bumper stickers. You know, I'm trying to think of all the memorable ones that come to mind are so crass that I'm not comfortable sharing them. I think I never felt like, at least in terms of pressure directed at me, I never felt like I was under the gun to go down the road, so to speak, and that the fact that I was dating someone here was somehow a strike against me. I never got that impression. Although I can understand how, you know, the women in my class and the class ahead of me and the class behind me and maybe for a couple years after would have felt that, you know, they weren't first on the list of a lot of guys to take to fancy dress. But it's funny because they stuck up for themselves, I mean, pretty effectively. I mean, I remember, what's the name of it? There was some association of W&L women. I don't remember what the acronym was, but they printed up some T-shirts. Maybe you've come across. I mean, I'm talking so much about T-shirts. I think that battles like this and messages are still communicated on college campuses through T-shirts. But so much. I was just telling a friend of mine we were out buying replacement T-shirts for the ones that have worn out. But I was telling him that I've got this. As I've been unpacking from a recent move, I was been digging through all these old T-shirts. I used to be of a mind that you can never have too many of them, and now I'm starting to reconsider that view. But I'm unpacking T-shirt after T-shirt from, you know, fancy dress T-shirts from 1986. I mean, for the past 10 years, I think I have just about every fancy dress T-shirt, and from Foxfield races, and from you know, all kinds of W&L events that are advertised and issues that are going on around campus, they ended up on T-shirts. In any event, the battle of co-education was waged in part on the chests of men and women at Washington and Lee. And the women, I remember, came up with these T-shirts that sold quite well, not only among women, but I think the bolder men wore them too. I don't know how many there were, but it, you know, women, this is highly derogatory, but women were referred to as cheese around campus. And if you were dating someone from, you know, a women's school from off campus, they were referred to as road cheese because you'd go down the road. And so I remember these T-shirts that they printed up. It was a wedge of Swiss cheese on wheels traveling down a road with the big red circle slash mark over top of it.
That's great.
Yeah, it was really, really witty, and I think the women who showed up on campus really they sold themselves in a sense.
Tell me what you mean by that.
I think there was probably some concern about amongst the board of trustees and the faculty and administration about, you know, how are we going to communicate to the students that women being here are a good thing? You know, how can we win them over? And I think the best way that they could do that and that they did that was by admitting the women that they did, because it was, in a sense, this sounds kind of inappropriate, it was a product that spoke for itself. I think a lot of guys who probably thought, you know, that you know, by golly, they were going to still go to Holland and Sweetbriar and Mary Baldwin, and you know, they were going to resist this co-education thing at the very end. You know, they found themselves getting to know women around campus and thinking, well, you know, why am I holding on to this silly notion that it's somehow less desirable to spend time with them? I mean, yeah, that's just human nature, I think, that barriers like that are broken down once communication is, you know, initiated. So they were, you know, particularly the first couple of classes. I think about some of the women in those classes, and, you know, you got to wonder what kind of woman wants to be among the first co-ed classes at a small institution like this. And I know this is an issue that, you know, VMI and the Citadel is, you know, facing now, and the service academies faced back, I guess, in the 70s, but a lot of them were just real firecrackers. I mean, just spitfires, and really remarkable people, and I count it a blessing that I was able to get to know a number of them and can still call them friends. You know, now they're out in the world doing wonderful things, whether it's in the professions or raising families or whatever else. I mean, they're just as effective ambassadors of Washington and Lee as any man who graduated from this place. So,
well, the ones I've met from those first couple of classes are very impressive people, I can tell you.
Am I allowed to ask you who that you?
Alexis Salzman.
Oh yeah.
I fell in love with her.
She's wonderful.
And
is she back for the soccer?
No, she
thing
came.
This weekend?
She was here in June. We had a seminar about the first 10 years,
mm-hmm.
And she and Dallas Haywood.
Dallas was in my class.
Yeah, and I interviewed both of them, and they just knocked me out.
Yeah,
they really just knocked me out.
There's another woman whose name might have popped up, Mary Alice McMorrow,
mm-hmm.
who was in my class, who was another remarkable go-getter. She probably, in some senses, was less diplomatic, or less given to diplomacy, let's say, than maybe Dallas or Alexa. I mean, she was, but I think it was played an important role in the co-education process here. I mean, she was, you know, very adamant about standing up for the women that were on campus here, while still not fully being what you would think of, you know, being labeled a feminist in any.
Do you know where she is now?
Let's see, Mary Alice was with Procter & Gamble in Cincinnati, but she has since moved to the West Coast. I believe she's in Los Angeles. I don't know who she's with. She went to, this will give you an idea of what kind of person she is. You know, she went and worked for Procter & Gamble in Cincinnati and then went to business school at the Darden School at UVA, got an MBA, and now she's maybe with an investment banking firm or something, I don't know, but I'm sure that Jim Fair would be able to track her down.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, they're great.
They're better than the IRS.
They know everybody.
Yeah.
Nobody escapes this place. Well, you know, Sean, there's a real little item here that we haven't talked about at all, and that's academics.
Mm-hmm.
I presume you did come here to go to classes.
Absolutely. And I guess...
Tell me a bit about your academic experience.
Sure, and I guess I've only not talked about it because we haven't... The questions, the open-ended questions haven't sort of led me there, but... And I think also because I always assume that as a given. When I talk about showing up on campus and seeing it and falling in love with it and knowing it was the right place. Part of that was, just seeing the classroom, seeing how big the classrooms were. I can't say that I knew anybody at that time that had come to Washington really, but academically, I wouldn't have been here in the first place had Washington really not fit the academic bill for me. I was fortunate to go to probably one of the best public schools in West Virginia, and I had challenging courses that prepared me, I think, fairly well for college experience. And I showed up on campus and remember my freshman year thinking that I was going to be able to kind of coast along, that it would be a lot like high school since I had such what I thought was a rigorous high school experience. The truth was, in high school, and I don't mean to sound like I'm some kind of brain trust, because as plenty of my colleagues or classmates, I'm not, but I didn't have to take a lot of books home in high school, and it seemed to come fairly easily. And midway through my first semester at Washington on legal, we got freshman midterm grade, I realized that this was not going to be the same kind of experience, that you actually had to read the assignments that were given to you, because you were going to be asked about them, if not in class, where it was embarrassing if you didn't know the answers, on exams and papers. I think I was a fairly good writer when I got to Washington and Lee, and it wasn't, and I came from a background where a lot of my exams were in essay format, so I wasn't uncomfortable having to answer essays, but what they were asking you about, the depth of knowledge that you had to have, whether it was philosophy class or history or economics or politics, and you really had to not only know the stuff, not only be able to regurgitate it, but you were expected to draw conclusions based upon what you knew. And so the first semester was an adjustment. I think I had a 3.0 after the first semester. And to someone who had never had anything through high school less than a 3.9, or so, you know, that was a shock, not only to me but to mom and dad. and I think my second semester fared a little bit better, but I think by the time that I was a sophomore, I sort of got in line and was had gone through the period of adjustment here and realized what was expected of me, and actually felt inspired to learn. And I owe that a lot to professors that I had. I worked a year in the admissions office, one of the years that I spent between college and law school. I spent as an admissions counselor working for Bill Hartog in the admissions office, which means that, you know, among other things, it's my job to advertise the university. And again, Washington Lee, I think, is a product that sells itself. And it was easy for me to go around the country and talk about what a great place it was academically, as in other respects, because I felt that way about it. And one of the things I would really impress, or try to impress upon high school students that I would talk to, was the kind of relationships that I had been fortunate enough to have with faculty members here. That, you know, I gathered from friends that had gone to larger institutions that they weren't able to have with their professors, either because they weren't being taught by professors, being taught by TAs, or you know, primarily because the classes were just so large and there wasn't the same accessibility to the faculty.
I need to turn the tape over.
Sure.